Welcome to Asia Rising, a podcast from La Trobe Asia, where we discuss news, views, and general happenings of Asian states and societies. I'm your host, Matt Smith. In 2004, Indonesia enacted the Anti-Domestic Violence Law, in what has been widely acknowledged as a progressive move and a major achievement for the women's rights groups who advocated for it. But despite the law being in effect for 20 years, domestic violence in Indonesia remains a persistent issue. Here to discuss issues around domestic violence in Indonesia is Dr. Balawan Jones, a lecturer in law and the Bendigo Law Convener at the Law School of La Trobe University. Thank you for joining me, Balawan.
Thanks, Matt.
If we can start with the numbers, can you tell us about the extent, the issue of domestic violence in Indonesia? How many cases are reported, and what does this number tell us about the prevalence of the problem?
With respect to domestic violence statistics, we always have to apply the iceberg principle, which is that what we can see, what cases are reported, that's just the tip of the iceberg. And this is due to both poor data collection and widespread underreporting. But with respect to the data which has been gathered and the cases that have been reported in Indonesia, it's the Ministry of Women's Empowerment and Child Protection that publishes the most recent statistics. In 2023, there were about 18,000 reports of violence in Indonesia. Women were the victims in the vast majority of these reports. 16,000 of the victims in these cases, and out of those 18,000, 11,000 cases related specifically to domestic violence. Mm. This captures, in a broad sense, some of the dynamics of domestic violence. One thing that it captures is the fact that victims in domestic violence cases are predominantly women, and the perpetrators in these cases are predominantly men. With respect to the Indonesian context, it largely captures a type of domestic violence, which is intimate partner violence, or IPV. So between husbands and wives that have marriages that are registered in law. This is important to note because in Indonesia, other forms of violence, such as partner violence or dating violence, where the marriage either isn't registered or the couple isn't married, these aren't captured. That's because the only data that is recorded is the data that relates to legally registered marriages. So that's an example of the limitations of the data collection, but also how it gives you an idea of how gendered the dynamics of domestic violence are. The other thing we have to take into account is the impact of COVID.
Yeah.
This is post-COVID, these numbers. But during COVID, there was what we call a shadow pandemic, which is that there was a huge spike in the amount of domestic violence that was being reported.
Mm. So if we could remove from those numbers a little, what's the reality on the ground? Is this a widespread problem?
Domestic violence is a widespread problem, and not just in Indonesia. All over the world, in Australia, domestic violence is recognised as a crisis. What we have to take into account is that the data collection and the awareness and the public policy responses to domestic violence are relatively new. So even in Indonesia, where the anti-domestic violence law was enacted in 2004, and you could think, oh, 20 years, that's quite a long time. Mm. But in the scheme of women's rights movements and awareness of this issue, 20 years isn't a very long time. And so we have a snapshot, but domestic violence isn't new, obviously, and it continues to be a problem. Now there's data being captured, which is a very important piece of the picture. And now there's actually public policy responses and funding being allocated towards dealing with domestic violence as a social problem, mm. which is a good thing. Arguably, we could always be doing more, both in the Indonesian context and other contexts internationally.
Okay, so tell me about the law then. What was it trying to address? And in your view, has it gone far enough? And is it being applied? And if not, why not? What's the nuances around the law?
It's a good question. If you look at the legal drafting of the Indonesian anti-domestic violence law, it's really relatively strong. For instance, the time at which It was enacted to criminalize domestic violence 20 years ago. That was a huge success for the women's rights movement. When we criminalize something, it's the state recognizing that there is a normative wrong, and then we are addressing that normative wrong by saying it's illegal, it's against the law. So it was a huge success at the time for the women's movement. The drafting recognizes domestic violence as being explicitly a violation of women's rights, as being a gendered form of violence, as having physical, sexual, psychological, and economic components, which is a really great understanding of domestic violence, legally speaking, because in other international legal context, the laws aren't as broad. So the drafting of the law is good in that sense. One of the things that people have critiqued more so than the particular drafting of the law is the implementation or application of the law during those 20 years. There are obviously a lot of areas for improvement in terms of implementation of the law. You have a law on paper, and that's fantastic. But if you have a promise of action without any substantive implementation of that promise, then the laws on paper can quickly become meaningless to victims on the ground. And our studies in Indonesia have shown that, like in many, many other contexts, there are compounding barriers to access to justice for victims on the ground. And that means that when women are in a position to report violence or to seek help for domestic violence, when they make a decision to report or to seek assistance, they practically sometimes cannot get the help that they need. And that could be economic barriers, that they're not financially independent. It could be geographical barriers, that there aren't services in rural or regional areas in Indonesia. It could be a social or cultural barrier, that they feel scared that they will have a stigma attached to them as a divorcee, for instance, if they seek divorce. It depends on the avenue through which they want to seek help. There could be a civil route where they seek a divorce, a criminal route where they seek to report violence as a crime, or there could be a more therapeutic route where they seek assistance with respect to their health or their well-being, an intervention which is non-legal, but still protection that's provided by the state. So we shouldn't assume that the implementation of the law is solely with respect to criminal law. There are many, many different avenues that victims of domestic violence can take.
Yeah.
But across those avenues, there are barriers to access to justice that remain for victims of domestic violence.
Is criminal law a common application for the law?
No. So I think there is a assumption or misconception that criminal law is
the
way to go, right? I think that criminal approaches are seen by people as, you know, tough on crime. They have a certain romanticized perception in the public. The reality is that very, very few victims of domestic violence seek to report violence to the police. Of those reports that are processed by the police, even fewer are actually prosecuted, and even fewer are, well, not convicted. It's not about the conviction. It's about whether the outcome of the case actually means anything to the victim.
Yeah.
So when I was doing the study, of those that are prosecuted, the vast majority are convicted, so found guilty, right? What does that actually mean in terms of their sentence? And what does that sentence actually mean in terms of the victim's safety? That's where there was a real disconnect between what victims wanted and what the criminal avenues were able to provide. And there was a few reasons for that. One, a big misconception is that a criminal case is not for the victim. It's prosecuted by the state. The victim is a witness for the state. And so even if a case is reported to the police, even if it's prosecuted successfully, even if there is a sentence given, the vast majority of those sentences were short and non-custodial.
Okay.
Even if they were custodial, they were very, very short. The time leading up to the trial was accredited as time in lieu. And so effectively, they were released when the case was decided.
Yeah, okay,
so what does
yeah.
that mean for victim safety? We need coordination between systems, because if the perpetrator, after the criminal case, gets out and he's just angry that he's been subjected to this whole process, there's a real lack of safety planning for women on one hand. So putting divorce to one side, because women may or may not seek to divorce a perpetrator when they bring a criminal case. That's another misconception, that women will necessarily want to leave the perpetrator or divorce. So putting that to one side, women's safety planning is one thing. And the other thing is therapeutic interventions for perpetrators, because there are real issues in terms of support and successful interventions for men's behavioural change. And one of the really disappointing things we're seeing in the Indonesian context with respect to the implementation of the law is that there is a provision in the law for these therapeutic interventions for men, basically counselling, perpetrator behavioural change counselling, that is in the law. But those programs have not been funded.
Okay.
They have not been established.
Mm.
And so there is this golden opportunity in the law where we recognize, and this is international best practice, right, that punishing people without any kind of attempt at behavioral change leads to angrier people at the end of the criminal process.
Mm.
Because if you can't get the perpetrator to see that they may have done something wrong, they're going to feel aggrieved through this process. And that's where the therapeutic intervention comes in, because we need to have behavioral change. We need to have attitudinal change. Otherwise, it's not a wasted process, but it can actually lead to more dangerous outcomes in terms of women's safety.
Mm.
So one of the really big things in our research that we've advocated for is simply the funding of the perpetrator behavioral change programs, or the therapeutic interventions, the counseling orders, whatever you want to call them, that is provided for in the law. The law is an excellent blueprint, but without the funding and the infrastructure, it's an empty promise that's contained in the law.
I'm interested in the role that religion would play in domestic violence in Indonesia. Indonesia being a country in which religion is a very influential institution that can have a role to play in the intervention, in the support, in a myriad of factors around domestic violence. And in particular, your research focused in the province of Aceh, where 98% of the population identify as Muslim. What did you find? What role did they play? What factors do they give the situation?
Yeah, really good question. So Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim democracy. It's not a religious state, but Islam is one of the official religions of Indonesia.
Mm.
Aceh, which is a province of Indonesia in the very north, is an interesting case study because it used to be an independent Islamic sultanate, and 98% of the population, as you mentioned, identify as Muslim. So one of the strengths of my study was that we're looking at a context where religion really is an influential code in terms of people's values, in terms of their beliefs, which obviously influence gender. And what can we learn from that, reflecting on the role? The first thing to clarify is that Islam doesn't have a monopoly on violence against women or domestic violence or anything like that, because I think a lot of studies in the past have tried to blame the religious background of perpetrators as a factor for domestic violence, which is not the correct approach. But it's important to understand the religious or cultural context whilst not marginalizing those communities. And the reason for this is that language around religion, values around religion, it's all coding, right? It's the language that we use. It's the way that we understand the world. And so if we're to have a conversation with people, it needs to be in that code. It needs to be along the line of those values and in that language.
Mm.
And this is particularly important when it comes to attitudinal change or behavioral change. one of the big disconnects in Indonesia between the wording of the law and the implementation of the law comes from the fact that there on the ground is a poor understanding of domestic violence and what that means and what its drivers or causes are. And internationally, it's recognized that the causes or drivers of domestic violence, it's gender inequality, values and attitudes, beliefs with respect to gender in our societies, whether religious or not. So the role of religion isn't to say, well, don't do that religion thing and then everything will be better.
Yeah.
The correct approach is to say, what does it mean to you, your religion, and how can we empower the people in our communities to support gender equality, to adopt interpretations of religious norms that support women's rights, and have a conversation that is actually grounded in those religious values. And of course, there will be people that say gender equality and religion, they're incompatible, but that's not true. There are incredible organizations internationally, in Indonesia, in Australia, doing the work of gender equality and women's rights and promoting gender equal interpretations of Islam that are becoming more and more mainstream.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we're working on is having more conversations with men across that gender divide and to have men taking up more responsibility, taking more of a role in this space as allies, because the work of nonviolence and advocacy against domestic violence really needs men to be part of the conversation.
I like how our conversation has drifted, and this is a good thing, slightly away from the law.
Yes.
Which, if I interpret correctly, is what your research has done.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that aspect of your research? What are you looking at now? And is that a challenging area to work in? What kind of roadblocks have you found yourself coming up against? I realized earlier on in the interview as well, you used the word advocating, which is not something that an academic will always go towards. They try to, you know, research and remain impartial and say, this is how it's going, not this is what we should be doing in this area. So tell me about inserting and changing how you do things. And
that's a really good question. So I am a lawyer. I started looking more narrowly, so we talked about criminal law, reporting to the police, policing processes, sentencing. In my research, I looked at divorce and the processes to get to divorce. And what I realized really quickly was that so few victims of domestic violence are using these formal legal processes, particularly the criminal ones. And as I mentioned before, even when victims of domestic violence use the criminal law avenues, the outcomes sometimes or often don't serve those victims in terms of their safety or in terms of their needs. So it's not a needs-based system. I also looked at ADAT, or culturally based dispute resolution, at the village level and how that was influenced by interpretations of Islam. This led me to think about the role of religion and culture and society more broadly. And when I came back to the Australian context, that interest continued because law doesn't exist in a vacuum, certainly shouldn't exist just on a piece of paper. So what is it that creates these barriers to implementation beyond, as I talked about before, financial barriers or geographic barriers? And one of these big barriers is legal literacy, or the way that people's personal values influence their interpretation and understanding of the law. So I started to move far more into the space where I was looking at community understandings. How does the community view the law? What are their needs? Is the law well placed as an institution to actually meet those needs? Who are these laws actually helping is a question. So my focus has certainly turned more to the work of women on the ground in our communities, particularly women's work in domestic violence refuges and domestic violence service provision in that space. So when it turns to advocacy, a lot of that is not my personal advocacy, but it's about giving a platform to women who are practitioners in this area,
mm-hmm.
women who are leading service initiatives in this area, and women with lived experience of domestic violence. So I see myself as a translator predominantly between the women who are doing the work,
yeah, yeah,
and these legal and formal institutions that speak a certain vocabulary, which can sometimes exclude the voices of women's organizations on the ground. So a lot of my enthusiasm in this area goes into assisting women's organizations with law reform proposals. How do you translate the needs of women and their advocates at the community level into these higher level law reform projects?
Yeah.
That's where the advocacy element comes in. I think a big misunderstanding about law, and I teach a lot of first year law subjects, is that the law just is. Law is like gender norms.
Mm, mm.
It's not universal and it's not forever. So we really need that creativity in there to think not only what is the law, but what could the law be. So that exercise of imagination to try and advocate for the law to actually serve the communities and to include people at the table that represent different communities is a huge interest of mine. So if you said to me, do you think that advocating for nonviolence and an end to domestic violence makes you an advocate? Yes and no.
Mm.
If I had to choose, I'd say yes. I'd much rather be an advocate for nonviolence and the elimination of domestic violence than not. But also, show me one good argument against that. Yeah. So it's inherent in the area because moves towards nonviolence and the elimination of domestic violence, that's an international moral and legal standard that we've agreed upon as an international community. And so I don't think it's controversial in the work to support the work of advocates and implicitly be an advocate yourself. If I have to choose between arguing for nonviolence and the elimination of domestic violence and against, I'm going to choose for every time.
Yeah, fair enough. You mentioned lived experiences in regards to supporting and what the victims need. What more work do you believe can be done in that in Indonesia? I guess not just in the societal context, but also if we can bring it back to the law in some way, do you believe the law is adequate or needs to be changed? What do you think can be done?
I think that there's still a long way to go when it comes to victim safety and the prioritization of victim rights in the Indonesian context. Of course, I could talk forever about the barriers to implementation and how funding really needs to be prioritized to implement some of the initiatives that have already been promised in the law. An example that I'm really passionate about, alongside the therapeutic interventions that need to be funded, is a promise in the law that states that victims have a right to protection in a refuge, right?
Yeah.
Across Indonesia, domestic violence refuges and the safe houses that are spelt out in that law have not been funded. They have not been established. So you have the law saying, trust me, report the violence, and you have a right in the law to a place in a safe house. And then you don't actually have the infrastructure dedicated to those safe houses. You don't have the funding of staff budgets and so on and so forth. And so then you have a really genuinely dangerous situation for victims that have relied on that promise and then have literally nowhere to go.
Mm.
I call it bureaucratic violence. I think that it actually creates a unique risk for women to promise them a certain right or service or safety and then to not deliver on that promise if they've relied on that.
Mm.
So I think as a first priority, there really needs to be the funding of those safe houses and refuges as provided for in the law. But beyond that, there's always work to be done. Initiatives that go to the core of these barriers to access to justice, that's what we need to see more of.
Balu and Jones, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Matt.
You've been listening to Asia Rising, a podcast from La Trobe Asia at La Trobe University. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, leave a review, or tell your friends about it. You can follow La Trobe Asia. We are on LinkedIn. You can also follow us on what is left of Twitter. Balawin is at Balawin Jones, and La Trobe Asia is at La Trobe Asia. This podcast was recorded at the Bendigo campus of La Trobe University on the traditional lands of Balawin. Whose land is this traditionally?
Jajawurung land, sovereignty over which has never been ceded. We pay our respects to the Jara elders, past and present.
Thank you. Until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, and thanks for listening.